time for breakfast.
Trauma for Breakfast is a crowded table of wounded children, parents, spouses, caregivers, and weary souls. Together, we join in honest conversations about the behaviors and challenges of parenting and working with children who've experienced trauma. There's always room for one more at the table to share in the stories, science, and healing as we learn to better understand and care for each other. We are a table without shame or judgment, because life can be hard and lonely, and we all know that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. I'm Stacy. I'm a mother of 7 children and have fostered for over 13 years. As an RN and former public school teacher, I quickly realized this type of parenting was not taught in a textbook or class. Let's learn together to parent different, not harder. Welcome to Trauma for Breakfast. Welcome, welcome to Trauma for Breakfast. I am your host, Stacy Gagnon, and I am just really excited to be here today with Jessica Cox. Jessica is going to actually be sharing life experience today. And to me, these are my favorite podcasts. It's not someone with just a bunch of letters behind their name. Today, I'm bringing a guest on who has lived experience. Jessica currently is a program specialist for Yavapai County Reentry Project, which is a pretty incredible project that works with inmates as they are released from jail. So Jessica's going to tell us some about that, but then also just about herself. So welcome, Jessica.
Good morning.
We are so glad that you could be here. Will you first just tell us what the Reentry Project is?
The Reentry Project is a program off of Matt Force. We're a 501c3, so we're a nonprofit. We're based around helping individuals coming from incarceration, whether it be prison or jail, to reenter back into society. We don't work with probation or courts or lawyers or judges, so it is specifically on their terms. We meet them where they're at. We have two parts of our program. We have the independent referral and we have the community coach. Independent referral are people with, I call it a little spicier background, you know? They have more violent crimes or weapons charges, sex offenses, things like that. It doesn't mean that we turn them away. It means that they would specifically be working with one of us staff. And then the community coach part are for people who have lesser crimes. Not violent, you know, and so they would be matched with a coach who, and our coaches are volunteers from the community who have gone through a training with us and who are here to help. We help them with things like applying for health insurance and food stamps if they can, making sure that they have a place to go, shelter, transitional housing, things like that, sober livings. Everything. We help them get to the MVD to try and apply for their license back. We are very boots on the ground, you know, trying to keep them from going back to prison. You know, the repeat offender thing is an issue, you know, and it's because most people that come out of prison or jail don't know that they have resources in their community to be successful. And yeah. So our job is to help them figure that out, you know, help them. And we're constantly growing. We're constantly finding new resources and new places and new things that are, you know, that are able to help.
And I love that because I know just having worked with inmates, you know, you're living in a survival mindset, right? And then you're released. And it isn't even just, it's also access to resources. It's like, you don't even know what you don't know. And it's so much more comfortable to just go back to what you knew prior. And so I've always loved that about reentry. Is Jessica, what is there something that has specifically helped you to be a better program specialist? Where are you getting your ability to navigate that world with inmates? And
because I'm from that world, when I meet them, I tell them I am you. You know, just a little later down the road, I was an inmate. I was a prisoner. I was a, you know, I did commit crimes and I am a felon. I come from a background that is it's pretty intense. So most of their stories aren't unique to me. Most of the people that come out of there, they need compassion and they need empathy, you know, and I am just pouring with that. I look at them just like I look at the people who raised me or the people who I grew up with, that I am you.
I love how you say that. And I think when you are working with any population, when you come in with this position of I'm better than you or higher than you, or I'm going to tell you what to do, it's not helpful. Right. And so I want to know how you've been successful, because you even said earlier, you know, like that recidivism rate is so high. And so how have you been able to basically stay on that straight and narrow?
Oh goodness. Honestly, for myself, it's this time you know, this last time, this is the last time. Service work, helping people. When I got into trouble this last time, I just couldn't believe that I was this age and had done this to myself again, done this to my children again. And so when I got this opportunity to be, I got accepted to the diversion program actually. And I could not believe it. I was the first person in Yavapai County to get accepted to the diversion program that had had prior felonies, because the diversion program is to keep you from getting your felonies. Since then, now they allow people who have already had felonies to come in and they help them with it. But I took it and I ran with it, and I was doing sponsoring and I was doing like a little bit of peer support for them, and I was just trying to help as much as I could, and it kept me busy and it kept me responsible.
I know a little bit of your backstory. So, you know, in working with so much of our inmate population, what I see as a common thread is adversity in childhood. Jessica, I would love if you were willing to share like some of the things that impacted you. I mean, just tell us maybe if you're willing your history so that our audience can really understand that when we're looking at our inmate population, the majority of them have been through some pretty hard childhoods. And so to me, their behaviors make sense in light of what's happened to them as kids. And so I would love to hear your story, Jessica, if you're
Well, I
willing.
would love to tell it. I feel like I throughout my life I've been like an oversharer. I just always am, you know, and I feel like it's subconsciously it's to let people know why I am, how I am, or where I came from, you know what I mean? And the thing is, I'm not ashamed of it anymore, but I came from, I guess, as rough a childhood as a person could have. I mean, and I'm not just like trying to like pity party myself. It's when I look back on it as an adult, that's what it was. When I was a kid, I had no idea. It was just life. I was just getting through it, you know. My mother was very young when she had me. She was 14 years old. She was, and I had already had my brother. She was addicted to heroin. I was born addicted to heroin. They had us on methadone supplements at birth, and my dad was 10 years older than her, and he's a drug dealer and a criminal, you know. And to start on both sides, I am a fourth generation addict on both sides. My great grandparents, alcoholics, and it trickled all the way down the line. And so she had my mother had given birth to me 14 years old, and then gave us up, gave me and my brother up, and then we went to foster care. She probably only had me about a month before she gave us up. And then I bounced around for a couple years, and I don't know anything about that. And then my grandmother took me. She was abusive and an alcoholic. She got us taken away because she had left marks on us, and CPS had seen it. And then my aunt and uncle had taken us in. My dad was in prison. My mother was nowhere to be found. And when they sent paperwork for him to sever his rights, he wouldn't give up his rights, and he was fighting for them through prison.
Okay.
So we didn't have the option to be adopted out.
So at this point, so you started at about at birth, 1 month of age or so, into the foster system for several years, and you don't even have probably photos or pictures or anything from that time, and then ended up with your grandmother at about the age of three or four.
About two. I was 2 years
Two.
old.
And then she was charged with being abusive. So then you went to an aunt and uncle. How old were you at that point?
I think I was two or three when my aunt and uncle took us. You know, they had three kids of their own already. When we'd gone to my aunt and uncle's, off and on throughout those years, we'd been taken in and out of there. My dad had showed up at some point when I was about 8 years old. He came and took us again. We were only there for a few months. My brother, and I were both severely sexually abused in that time. And then he went back to prison. I don't remember the sexual abuse then. My brother remembers. And then he went back to prison. We went back to my aunt and uncle's. And then when I was 11 years old, my dad got back out of prison and we went to live back with him. And that's when I feel like a majority of my trauma comes from. Like I had already had trauma, you know. We had already been sexually abused, and I mean, just really done rough when we were babies. And then when I moved in with my dad, that's when I started using drugs.
At 11.
At 11. And not just like smoking weed or anything, like intravenous drug use.
Nothing that you say, and it's shocking to hear, obviously, like such a hard childhood, but at the same time, even saying that you don't remember sexual abuse, like that was the same for me. But when you look at trauma, especially being a child, the brain just compartmentalizes that stuff. And so it says trauma comes back as a reaction, not a memory. So we don't remember those things as having a beginning, middle, and ending. We actually remember that trauma as like sensory imprints. When we see kids in care, or when we see kids in our classroom or in our homes who have these behaviors or struggles around things, a lot of times it's that sensory imprint that's pushed, that button that's pushed, and that memory comes back and we see this behavior. And so I imagine as 11-year-old at that point, all the chaos and the turmoil and the pain and the hurt was going to be medicated by drug use. I am so sorry that you experienced that so young, Jessica. It just, no wonder. I mean, who wouldn't turn to something? So at 11, then you were living with your dad.
Yes.
Right. And started IV drugs. And you know, what happened from 11 to 18?
I started using drugs. I started selling drugs for the people. Like when I lived with my dad, it wasn't me specifically living with my dad. I ran away. Things happened that I don't talk about with my father and I. So I ran away. I ran away all the time. I did whatever I wanted. And my dad would take off for months, you know, and I wouldn't hear from him or see him. And there'd be no electricity or food in the house. And then, I get put in a foster home, or I get put in a group home, or a teacher would see that I hadn't, you know, that I lost a substantial amount of weight and asked me if I'd be okay coming to stay with them for a while. I went to the juvenile center. I remember at one point, my cousin showed me the newspaper and it had my picture in it. And I think I was 14. And it said, if you see this young lady, do not pick her up, call the authorities.
Wow.
Because I had run away so much. I had friends, parents hide me from my dad. You know what I mean? When he'd come looking for me.
What do you wish people would have understood about you at that age? Because I'm hearing you say, like, I was in foster homes and then teachers would notice. Or what do you wish someone would have asked or understood?
I think that people, the good people, the few good people, adults that I had in my life, I think that there was no way for them to understand or comprehend. For the few reliable adults I did have, they did the very best they could, and that was just far and few between. You know, that was a counselor once, or the principal of my school one time. You know, I had gone to 15 schools. I had moved 20-25 plus times just in high school. You know, I would be doing really well, and then all of a sudden some caseworker from the state would come out of nowhere and pick me up and drive me to the middle of nowhere to go live with this foster family in a trailer 30 miles away from any town. And I wouldn't know anybody and wouldn't know anything. And I'd be put in situations where I had to defend myself.
How terrifying. So you went to juvenile twice then during
Yes.
your teen years?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that experience?
In the town I grew up in, off and on, to go to jail or go to prison gave you clout. It made you look cool. It made you seem tough so you didn't get bullied.
Mm-hmm.
And I was tough. I was tough. And I was quick to aggression because I didn't know any other way. I feel like the safest times in my childhood were in the juvenile center.
Wow. Was there a turning point for you? Do you feel like in your life, I always think there's sometimes that hockey stick moment where you're like, oh my gosh, this isn't who I want to be. Or did you have that turning point, or was it more of a slow progression to change?
No, I think that I had gone to this group home that was in Mesa. And when I got there, I saw a different style in people, and I saw people that liked music, and they like we could join sports. And it was so different from anything I'd ever seen, you know? And the sad part was, and I remember thinking about this when I was a kid, none of my friends, if my friends could see this place, you know what I mean? If the people I grew up with could see this place, you know, or because where I come from, my story, it is no different from any other kids, which is, I mean, I'm not exaggerating. We have every single one of us sitting in class and making friends in second grade because the girl next to me, her mom was in prison. At the same time, my dad was in prison. We were talking about it. And then We were kids on the street. Like, we were all raised on the streets. We were raised slinging drugs when we were really young. I feel like because I was able to go to, like, I didn't have family to take me, and I was moved around so much, it gave me a sense, a little more sense of a culture from other places, and understanding that the world is a little bigger, which makes me sad because when I hear about the people I grew up with, they that never got out of there, that are still in the same life because they know no different. So for me, I feel like all that moving around, as awful as it may have been, it showed me that this world is so much bigger than all of where I grew up.
How do you think it's changed your parenting?
Oh my goodness. I'm a bulldog parent. I am a no nonsense mom, you know, but at the same time, my kids are, especially my youngest, he is extremely open with me, a little too much. Yeah. I think that it has, it's frightened me a little bit, you know what I mean? Because I do remember circumstances for myself where things just happen so fast. So I'm always like thinking about that. I'm always asking my kids like ridiculous questions and just like really drilling them, you know what I mean? And at the same time, I also feel like it gives me a sense of leniency on how they react to things, if they throw a tantrum, if they're fighting. I was up and down. I had no control over my emotions. I was a holy mess, you know what I mean? When I was a kid, I was mean to every adult around me because I didn't trust anybody. I was just a hot mess. I could not control myself. So when my kids lash out, I look at them and I'm like, their tantrums ain't nothing compared to what I was, you know? So it gives me a little bit of I guess calmness.
Well, and they trust you. That's that. I
Yeah.
think that it sounds like in your childhood, Jessica, like, what trust did you have for anybody, right? Or
Never.
trust for your mom or
Never.
your dad or for any home you were in or teacher? I mean, you were being yanked around and moved from chaos to calm, back to chaos to, I can appreciate how, as a mom now, you probably just see things with a different lens. And so, and I love it that your youngest overshares. Like, he
Yeah.
obviously trusts you, right?
Yeah.
Well, all right. What would you tell a parent who has a child incarcerated or someone that has a loved one that's incarcerated? What would be your word of advice for them?
Coming from the incarcerated person point of view, stay in contact with them. That one letter, even if it's once a month, is everything because they are going to reread it a million times, almost every single day. That contact, that making sure that they are not alone. It's everything. I can't push that enough with the incarcerated part. Just stay in contact with them. You don't have to put money on their books. You don't have to go see them. None of that. Just write them a letter. Answer the phone once in a while. Just stay in contact. Make sure that they know that they're not alone. Abandonment is lifelong. It lasts with you and it carries into every single relationship, everything you do. Abandonment and grief, they will depict everything in your life. And if a person is in sitting in a cell by themselves with just their mind and nobody is coming to see them and nobody's writing them, they have nothing outside of their own mind. It's awful. There are too many people on this planet for us to be alone. We are
Absolutely.
not meant to be isolated.
100%. And
Yeah.
I think that's the hardest thing, Jessica, when you look at like what you've gone through or other adults with what we call complex developmental trauma is the trauma happened at the hands of the people that are supposed to love you. It's relational trauma, and it's so much more damaging than, you know, a one-off traumatic event. It is, there's no exit strategy. You're hurt by who's supposed to care for you. And so then there's that abandonment piece too. I am so proud of how brave you are and how you have overcome such incredible odds and adversity. And then to take that pain and put some purpose behind it in what you do with the Reentry Project. I can't imagine that you are not just a light of truth for so many of those men and women that you work with. I guess I'm just grateful for what you do and that you're using what was so bad and turning it into something that is good in helping and serving others. So thank you for that.
I can't believe where I'm at. I can't believe the place that I get to work for. I feel like every single bit of trauma, every single bit of every mistake I ever made, every wrong that was done to me or that I did is so useful in my job. It's unbelievable. I love what I do. I feel like I'm really good at it. I feel like I'm doing what I'm meant to be doing.
It's so, there's so much in your story that just is mind-boggling to me. Just even the fourth generation of addiction, and you know, everything with genetics and all the things. I mean, again, Jessica, I will reiterate, you are a survivor, and so I love hearing your story, and I hope that our listeners who are maybe struggling with a family member or a child or someone that is in that space of like, is there any hope, can look at this and see that there always is hope, right? And so, you know, I always say that adverse childhood experiences are ACEs. They're fact, they're not your fate, right? And so there are facts behind Jessica's past, but it has not been her fate. Krista, do you have any questions for Jessica?
Well, first off, I want to say thank you, Jessica, for sharing your story. You're definitely an inspiration. You know, Stacy and I talk about this a lot. Hearing your story when you were in school and you did have people that would try to help you, how many years ago was that then, would you say, that like people would like in school?
Three different teachers throughout my life, throughout my childhood, took me in. My first one was in Mesa, Mr. and Mrs. Wise. I think it was 13, for, no, 12. And they only had me for a couple months. He was just a good, he was my history teacher. He taught me about the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Trojan Horse and just Greek mythology and all the things. And it was just so cool.
Jessica, hearing that, I know that a lot of people were trying to help you. Did you feel a sense of like the not worthy or the not having confidence of somebody that
Oh,
was
yeah.
trying to help you? You know, we talk about this a lot with kids that have experienced trauma. You adopt those kids and you don't get over that trauma. I know that you're always pushing forward. There's always something new. There's a different hurdle because that trauma is so ingrained in that child and allowing them time to believe that they're a good person, right?
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit, Jessica.
I was discouraged when it came to anybody or anywhere I was going. That was the reason he connected with me. I was in class and I was being a little pushed back, you know, and he's like, Jessica, you haven't been turning in any of your papers. I'm like, it's not gonna matter. They're gonna move me anyway. Like, I'm not doing the project that's due in 3 weeks because I'll be gone in two. I'm not going on that field trip, so it doesn't matter. But I said it in much nastier words and much louder because I had to be. He's like, what are you talking about? You'll see, like they're gonna move me. He got connected with the principal, who got connected with the social worker, and just kind of moved down the line. And he kept me just for a few months. When I packed my bag that day to leave his house because a new social worker had come and got me. I looked at him and I said, I told you. I mean, he bawled his eyes out. He didn't know what to say, he didn't know what to do. But he looked at me and he said, Jessica, and he grabbed me on my shoulders and he goes, you are the type of person, the type of student, type of child that made me want to teach, that killed me. And then a few years later, they transferred me back to Globe. And I'm living with my aunt again. I have my little brother and my little sister with me. I'm on probation by now. I'm troubled. I've already been to prison, you know, between that time. And we are starving. Literally, we have no electricity in our house. And my aunt is highly addicted to drugs and just spends no money on food. On my 13th birthday, she beat me up so bad that she broke my nose and blackened both my eyes, and I had to go to school the next day. I had already been approached by my English teacher and my music teacher a couple weeks before this because they said that I was really thin and I had bruises all over me. And so after that, I started wearing a big jacket. I told him everything was fine. Every day he'd ask me, what'd you eat for dinner last night? Well, on my 13th birthday, after that had happened, I had to go to school the next day, and I couldn't get off the bus because my eyes were so swollen. I just couldn't see, you know, and I was so embarrassed. He had come onto the school bus and he sat in the seat in front of me and he said, Jessica, I can't let this go anymore. I have to call somebody. And I was like, I'll lose my baby brother and my baby sister. They'll take us away. They'll split us up, or they'll leave them with her. So what he did is this school, he had contacts in the valley. They asked me if I wanted to go on a tour of this group home. It's the one I told you guys about that had like diversity and culture and like even art and music. And so they secretly took me on a they took me from school without my Aunt Glenda knowing and took me on a tour of this place and told me that if I go to court and I stand against my aunt saying that, you know, she abused us and neglected us, that my brother and my sister and I would all go to this place. I said, absolutely. Oh my God. I go back to the school. The next day, the cops come and they pull me, my brother, and my sister out of school. Yeah, they take us to court and I sit down. They put me on the stand in front of my Aunt Glenda and they said, what happened? You know, and I told them, you know, she thought I was throwing away her dishes or something like that. And she had grabbed a trash bag off of the porch and I was sitting on the steps and she ripped it open on top of me to go through her trash to find her dishes I had apparently thrown away. And when I yelled at her because I was so embarrassed, she kicked me right in the face and broke my nose. And I told them this. So it goes on. And at this point, when the day that the cops had come, they had taken my brother and sister to a foster home. And they had taken me, the teacher that I was talking to, him and his wife had taken me in just temporary until I went to this group home. And so I go to this group home a few months later. They never brought my baby sister and my brother. My baby brother and my baby sister went back with my Aunt Glenda. Yeah. And I didn't see them for months. And my little sister got really, really sick. She had ulcers in her lower intestines from stress. And she was maybe 7, you know? And this now she has a debilitating disease from it, from stress and not eating when she was that young. After that, I spiraled, went hardcore into drugs and went back to prison again. And all kinds of messy stuff happened. And then they transferred me back to Globe. And I'm in high school. I'm about a year away from graduating. And mind you, throughout all of this, I'm a straight A student. My home life was so bad that school was everything. I go to my principal because I had been told that morning by my caseworker that I needed to pack my stuff. I was being moved again. So I go to my principal and ask for my transcripts. And she says, where are you going? And I was like, I honestly don't know. I said, I have court at 3:30, but I have to get my transcripts and I have to turn in my books. And I walked to the courthouse with my duffel bag. I'm standing there and the judge is like, so we have no family, no friends, nobody to take this girl. Nobody at all. He's like, we're going to have to sit. She's going to have to go to the juvenile detention center until we can find something to do with her. You know, and when you go to the detention center and you haven't been in trouble, they don't know that. So they treat you like you've been in trouble the whole time. And I'm feeling so depleted and so abandoned, just so like, God, tired of it, you know? And the principal of my school busts through those doors. She's a chunky Mexican lady, just runs through those doors. And she's like, I'll take her. I'll take her. I'll take her. Yeah, so they let her take me. And, you know, I'll never forget her. And I stayed with her for a couple of years.
Again, Jessica, just reiterate what a survivor that you are. And I'm so sorry you were failed by the system so many times. But then I also see like the glimmers of like humanity and the people that stepped up, right? Like the system's broken, but good people need to be in the system because the system's broken.
The last judge, because you have to see a judge every time they switch up your case, you know, and you have a guardian ad litem and you have all these things. But that's what he said to me. His name was Judge Duber. And he said, Ms. Cox, you've been beaten and torn down and thrown away by the system and forgotten and literally lost in the system. And he said, for that, I apologize. But you, Ms. Cox, you are a survivor.
You are now joining the system as a good person to affect change. I hope you see it as being full circle.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing your heart and your story today and your vulnerability. And I feel like you're such a, in so many ways, as an inspiration to so many who are struggling or who are walking alongside someone that's struggling, that, you know what, we just keep showing up and loving the best we can. I thank you all for joining us today on Trauma for Breakfast. And we hope that you went through a box of tissues just like we did today. We'll see you next time.
We're so thankful that you all shared in today's conversation. We are always here and ready to set one more place at the table. Thanks for joining us on Trauma for Breakfast.
Trauma for Breakfast is brought to you and supported by Matt Force, working together to reduce substance abuse, and Yavapai County Community Health Services, working toward healthier communities.